This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson wins another term in office, and Barack Obama works his magic in New Hampshire. Joining us today from our New York bureau is Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post. At Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we've got Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the city's television show Beat the Press, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education and co-director of immigration studies at New York University. Joins us from member station WLIU in Southampton, New York. So thanks, everybody, for being with us. And let's move on to William Jefferson. He won a runoff after a dramatic race for the congressional seat that covers New Orleans. Here's Jefferson late Saturday night, just after his victory.
I think what is called for now is unity. On the East Bank, on the West Bank, black and white, rich and poor throughout our district, with one objective: to recover this great and wonderful city that God has left to our stewardship.
Now, Jefferson faced Louisiana State Senator Karen Carter, who is also African-American. An analyst said before the vote that race would decide who won. That is, Carter needed to woo the white vote to beat incumbent Jefferson. Jefferson won overwhelmingly. So, Callie, what happened there, and was race a factor at all?
Well, I think that race probably was a factor in that he had such a strong support from Jefferson Parish, which is overwhelmingly black. Though I have to say, I'm still open-mouthed, but I was an open-mouthed woman when Ray Nagin won. So I clearly have no sense of the pulse of what's going on there. I think that he has quite the challenge to demonstrate to people that he is worthy of their vote, because even though he said he's guilty of nothing and they've charged him with nothing, this federal bribery thing where the agents claim to have found $90,000 in his freezer is hanging over him. And try as I might, I can't come up with a reason why one would have $90,000 in their freezer, but that's neither
here
nor there.
Well, to give it to me, I think that's the answer. I mean, aside from that, Robert, I mean, what about the race card, if you'll want to call it that? I mean, you know, as Callie said, Ray Nagin, some folks counted him out, but he wasn't.
That's right. And Karen Carter, from all analysis, she was, for want of a better phrase, the white candidate, or the candidate for the white voters there, and Jefferson got all the black vote. Like Callie, I'm a little bit stunned myself, but you know, I'm sure a lot of people have lost money trying to bet on Louisiana politics. I will say, though, in terms of the larger picture, this is probably kind of a nightmare for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in Congress, because obviously they ran on the whole culture of corruption issue, and in most of the races in November, either Republicans who were in scandals, they either lost re-election, or if they had already resigned, that seat switched over to a Democrat, and now they've got Jefferson, you know, with the FBI investigation and the raid on his office and all of this hanging over their heads, and now they look like they have the primarily corrupt member of Congress still seated.
Marcelo, do you think that this is going to be kind of stinging for the Democrats, as Robert hinted? Is this going to be a situation where the ethics issues facing William Jefferson are going to come back to bite his party?
I think Robert has a very, very good point, and I think that moving forward, this is one issue that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership are going to have to look at very, very carefully and manage very, very carefully, pending the various developments in terms of the investigation. But I think, again, I concur with both Callie and Robert that this is not a good time to bet on politics in Louisiana, that this is very, very interesting and unorthodox development. Clearly, Carter didn't get the massive support of the white vote, and in that sense, it was a racially coded vote.
Yeah, you know what was...
Can I add two things?
Please, go ahead.
First of all, let me just say that I think Robert's right about bringing up the fact that Nancy Pelosi has to handle this very carefully. But remember, she's already been roundly criticized for stripping the man of his committee membership leadership. And I think that that's important, that what Democrats can say, at least through her, is that, look, when we saw there was a problem, we dealt with it even despite criticism, which is not what the Republicans could stand up and say around the Foley thing. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is, based on what your conversation earlier in the show about Katrina and what's happening there continuing to happen, he has got to deliver the bacon on Katrina. And one of the things that is happening is that Bobby Jindal, who is a congressman from Louisiana, is delivering the bacon. I mean, he is responsive to those folks. And believe it, he's going to be running for something bigger than the seat that he holds now. So I think that
Republican member.
So what I'm saying is that Jefferson can probably save his seat in himself by bringing home that bacon, by being the voice of the Katrina folks and being strong about that. And maybe that might temper some of the federal bribery stuff. But I think that the Democrats have at least stepped out and protected themselves by stripping him of the leadership ahead of time.
Well, let's move on to someone who has become quite the darling, Senator Barack Obama. He was in, of all frosty places, New Hampshire, which, Robert, as you know, is generally known as a conservative state. You know, it's where the presidential campaign really kicks off and where all the political pundits get to go and have cocktails every 4 years.
Coffee at the diner.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, here's the thing. Barack Obama is by no means a conservative. He, you would think that his stance on the war might kind of turn some people off, but apparently New Hampshire has been very much critiquing the war itself among its politicians and among its citizenry. And he just ran through that state, collecting all sorts of, folks for book signings and public events. And people were just absolutely delighted. And he closed his speech on Sunday night with these words: "This is our time. A new generation is prepared to lead." What do you make of all this, Robert?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you have to keep in mind that New Hampshire switched pretty strongly from red to blue in this past election. Democrats are running the entire state government for the first time since, I think, the end of the Civil War. So you have to keep that in mind. Secondly, Obama is he's really the fresh flavor right now. I think people are tired of. I don't think they're exactly looking forward to the prospect of Bush Clinton, and he obviously electrified the country. Even in some conservative voices, Rich Lowry at National Review has written a couple of rather flattering columns about Obama because of that he manages to speak in an evangelical sense without seeming hectoring. He sounds like he definitely kind of wants to be a new generation to move almost in a sense, wants to incite the idea of post-baby boomer politics, feeling that we've been caught up in these culture wars for the last 30-some years. So it certainly seems like he's getting a rather interesting hearing in New Hampshire.
Marcelo, I think that, one thing that this raises is, many times people have asked, is Barack Obama really going to run, or is he just doing this to secure a more visible place in the Democratic Party?
And sell books.
And sell books. Mm-hmm. I mean, Marcelo, it's way too early to really make a prediction, but what's the sense you get? Is he becoming much more serious of a candidate, or is he still really kind of fishing?
I think he's becoming more of a serious candidate. I think that there is something very interesting historically here. Somebody commented on the New Hampshire event. There has not in a long, long time been a crowd this big, this early. And there was a kind of an electricity in the air. Some said that you haven't seen in American politics since JFK. I think what this really represents is the country's ready to, as the senator said, turn the page. And there's a kind of an electric quality to his discourse. He's a formidable orator. And I think that New Hampshire is ready to change the page, and the country's ready to change the page. The question is, will the new page be a blank page? And that is, in a way, both his strength and will come back as his number one weakness, that there isn't really a solid record. But I think we're witnessing something very, very interesting and very, very appealing. This is more than about selling books.
Callie, let's go to the generational issue. There's kind of a split screen here. On the one hand, people can look at Senator Barack Obama and say, well, he hasn't spent that long in national politics. He's young and not experienced. On the other hand, he's using his generation to his own aims. You know, this is our time. A new generation is prepared to lead. Is this more of a plus or more of a minus, his age and his experience?
Oh, I think his age is a plus. His experience, people are always going to raise that. And I think they're always going to raise it because I'm, you know, conspiracy theorist with regard to black people, particularly around black folks. I mean, our current president didn't have that much experience when he became president, let's remind folks. So I think that there's going to be some of that about the experience. That's going to happen. Now, the fact that he has not a strong record is slightly different. It's in the same umbrella, but it's slightly different. And that means when people go back to see, well, what have you done since you've been in the Senate? That has less to do with experience and more to do with, okay, what are you going to do if you were the president? Where will you lead us? That, I think, we'll probably hear more and more of. But the same kind of criticism has been directed at Hillary Clinton as well. So maybe that's a wash.
And
what I worry about is that the expectations of him are so high. He's himself has said he's not believing the hype. But with expectations as high as they are, how he manages that is really key. I believe he managed it well coming into the Senate as the first African-American in decades. And people were like, okay, finally, he's going to do a whole lot. And he managed somehow to sort of mitigate a little bit of that and get folks grounded in reality. But this is a whole other playing field. I just don't know.
We should mention Carol Moseley Braun was a senator, so the whole decade.
Yes, I said in decades. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Robert, briefly before we move on to one more topic.
Yeah. What I was going to say was, one, he also got his name quicker than, say, Hillary Clinton. He got his name on a significant piece of legislation that became law when he worked on the bill with Republican Tom Coburn to expose earmarks. So he can say that, you know, I showed up and I definitely have already made my imprint on the Senate. And the experience issue, by the way, it's not just racial. I mean, they made the same questions. It was one of the same issues that I think helped Deep Six John Edwards' campaign as well. So, I mean, I think that's a legitimate point.
All right. Well, Robert, maybe you can bring us in on our next topic. It relates to our previous segment on Louisiana. Now, it's about affordable housing, and it seems like we're regressing on the issue. A new survey released from the League of Cities says that about one-third of U.S. cities have less affordable housing than they did a year ago. And the pace of apartment building may have something to do with it. So you've got property values going up in a lot of places, rents going up with them, predatory lending. What needs to happen here on a governmental level?
Well, I have to question whether the need has to be on a governmental level, because speaking only of New York City, which I know of, one of our problems in the view of conservative critics is that we have too many rent and housing regulations, whether it's a rent stabilization or a rent control. I mean, you lived here for quite a while, so you know how it's played here, and that frankly creates an artificial market that, in a sense, gives negative incentives to builders and to landlords and increases the problem of abandoned buildings and so forth. What you're starting to see happening in both large cities and also some smaller cities, though, you're starting to see individuals, both on the nonprofit side, working with businesses to try and trying to figure out how to start building more affordable housing. And I think that may very well be the future, because once the government gets involved in it, it seems it creates more complications than it actually solves.
Well, Callie, you know, in New Orleans, what has happened is that, and obviously that's a very specific case, and New York in some ways is a very specific case. But in New Orleans, you have a situation where there's all this damaged housing stock, and people who want to come back in the city and work just don't have any place to live that they can afford. It may be much less so in a lot of other cities, but I mean, one thing that's happened in a lot of places, I mean, you take the upscale ski resort towns like Aspen and Vail, and a lot of times the people who work there can't actually afford to live even within a couple hours of it.
Absolutely. And I think you've struck something that struck upon something that, I mean, New Orleans is a very specific example, but something that I wanted to mention is that when we think about affordable housing, we tend to think low-income housing. We're talking about folks in the middle class trying to find affordable housing, and that needs to be on the table. I hate to sound like Lou Dobbs here this morning, but that's a really, I think, going to bring this issue to the forefront through our representatives in ways that perhaps it hasn't been in the past. I mean, I live in a suburb of Boston where the vacancy rate was 1% when we had rent control, less than 1%, and now that went away. I don't even know what tiny percentage point there is now. And, you know, people cannot afford to even aspire to buy housing or to rent it.
Callie.
It's ridiculous.
Only reason I'm cutting you off is we're almost out of time. Marcelo Roberts says this isn't an issue for the government. Do you think it is or not?
Well, it is certainly in the case of Louisiana. It is certainly in the case of New Orleans, where we need a much, much more ambitious, much, much more aggressive coordination here of government. And, of course, the NGOs, the private sector, also has an important role to play. But this is part of a national crisis. Increasingly, our cities, our big cities, are cities where middle-class people, the people that make the cities run, they can't afford to live. This is true certainly in New York, but this is true in many, many cities. This is a crisis. This is really where the rubber meets the road. And we need an agenda that will involve multiple players. The government has a role. Certainly the private sector has a role. But it can't be that people cannot live in the places where they work. That's very bad for our communities.
And it has impact on energy as well, because people have to drive more, which, of course, raises gas prices as well.
All right. We're going to have to wrap it up. Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on Boston's Beat the Press, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at NYU. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.